You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. My name is Li Chen, and I'm the director of the China Center here at the Brookings. It is my honor to welcome you to today's event on the state of U.S.-China relations. The event is co-sponsored by our distinguished guests, colleagues from the China Institute of International Studies, or as we fondly refer to as CIIS. Please do not confuse them with CSIS, who also have a few distinguished scholars with us today. And the CIIS is a leading Chinese foreign policy think tank, directly affiliated with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Brookings has a long history of collaboration with the CIIS. And only a few months ago, Brookings Executive Vice President, Ambassador Martin Index, and I visited their beautiful headquarters in Beijing. By the way, that Martin sends his warm regards to you and your colleagues. I'm thrilled that we have this opportunity to hear keynote remarks by Ambassador Su Ge, who only recently was appointed president of CIIS. His remarks will be followed by a panel discussion featuring both Chinese and American perspectives on U.S.-China relations in advance of President Xi Jinping's state visit to Washington in late September, less than 2 months from now. President Su Ge is no stranger to the United States. He earned his master's and a PhD degree at the Brigham Young University in Seattle, right? In Hawaii?
Utah.
In Utah, okay. So what's the university in Hawaii? Is it different? Oh, college. Thank you for correcting me. And he served as minister counselor at the PRC embassy in Washington between 2003 and 2006. Is that correct? Okay, thank you. And he has gone on to serve as the Chinese ambassador to Suriname and ambassador to Iceland. I'm sure that his time in Suriname prepared him well for this heated weather, you know, in Washington, D.C. But my guess is that he is wishing he were in Iceland at the moment instead. However, we are so pleased that he and his colleagues have braved the heat to be here with us today to herald a more conducive climate for U.S.-China relations in advance of President Xi's visit. With that, please join me in welcoming President Su Ge. Please also have the Brookings tradition while we're talking, you are eating. And so we will continue that program. It will last for about 1 hour and maybe, you know, 1 hour and a half. Okay, please.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Li Chen. So when I got the invitation to this working lunch, I thought, now, wow. Lunches in America are now free. But then they said, you're asked to say a few words. I think lunches are not free. Well, to return to academic world, to me, if I quote a Chinese saying, my feeling is that I'm like a fallen leaf which returns to the roots of the tree. 落叶归根啊. And I would like to, it's my great pleasure and honor to meet all of you and then at a prestigious Brookings Institution to share a few thoughts with you about how the United States can jointly build up a new model of major country relationship between United States and China. As you all know, now we are living in a flat world, mass media plays such an important role. And what we see from the mass media is that there has been a growing mistrust between China and the United States. Some people worry about a tipping point. Others predict that looks like the United States, the status quo power, are China and the rising one. These two are inevitably going to have embark upon the road of conflict, a fate described by the Greek historian Thucydides. Well, if I may quote a line from the American linguist Noam Chomsky, because he talks about the surface structure and deeper structure. I thought if we take a look at from the deeper structure, and my personal opinion is that U.S.-China relations would not seem that gloomy, and it seems that the basis of cooperation between these two great countries is still solid. Now, Chinese think tankers very often talk about the two salient trends in international situation, meaning globalization and multipolarization. What would these two trends mean for the relationship between U.S., United States, and China? I tend to see this as globalization means that there is an increasing interdependency between China and the United States. Hence, the two countries need to have more cooperation. And the multipolarization would mean that problems in the world are growing to be more and more complicated and complex. And the problems would be harder for anyone to handle them single-handedly. And the problems need to be resolved through concerted efforts. Hence, the more need for the United States and China to consult with each other, since they are now the number one and number two economies among the world, among others. Of course, both are members of the Security Council of the United Nations. And as you can see that as a student who has been trained from both China and United States, I already started my argument from the well-known three of multi-level analysis in the international relations. I already started with the analysis on the international level. If I proceed with the national level and the personality level, here are some thoughts how I would see as representing the convergent points so far as the national interests are concerned between United States and China. I would think that despite of the myriad of differences portrayed by the mass media, and of course with our mass media people here, I dare not to say anything bad about them, but it seems that the mass media would normally portray or carry something sensational. If a newspaper carries news about a train leaving the platform on time, and or an airplane arrives with all its passengers on board, now who's going to read that newspaper? So what my point is that U.S.-China relations, got to have differences. However, when they are portrayed by the media, and certain things may have to be enlarged. I think that when you look at the deeper structure of the United States and China national interests, I tend to see both sides would need a peaceful and stable international order, especially when we are commemorating the 70th anniversary of the war against fascists in the world. Now, both would need an open international market and the freedom of the seas for normal world trade. And we have carried out effective cooperation in the United Nations, G20, APEC, and Iran nuclear issue, Korean and Southern Sudan, just to mention a few. And in counterterrorism and in the prevention of weapons of mass destruction, and even in transnational organized crimes, etc., we carried out effective cooperation. And in the two countries have agreed on an extensive agreement on emission deduction and setting an example to the world. And we have also cooperated in fighting against Ebola in Africa. So these are a few examples to show that we do have, and we can, and we do have convergence of important national interests. And China and United States, speaking of the bilateral economy and trade, economics and trade, United States and China, we are each other's second largest trade partners. The bilateral trade reached $591 billion last year, and showing an increase of 5.1%. And with the possible agreement on the BIT, and we can have good hope for bilateral trade and bilateral investment to enter a new stage. Now, when we already talk something about the international national level, then we move on to decision making. Well, the new model of major country relationship has been a thing talked about by the two presidents. First, and they talk about it at Sunderland, and also they talked about it at Zhongnanhai. And what does that mean? And I think there has been a consensus that so that both countries would consider building up a relationship would contain non-confrontation, which would be based on mutual respect and strive for a win-win end. I think that the President Xi Jinping is going to have his first state visit in this coming September. And this will be the last state visit from China. President Obama is going to, the delegation President Obama is going to receive during his presidency. By mentioning the last, we do not say that it's not going to be important. We mean that it's going to be an important occasion so that the summit meeting will have an important historic legacy, which would, whatever they agreed upon, would have a lingering impact on the ensuing years to come. Therefore, I think that the visit and the summit meeting will open up a new prospect for mutually beneficial cooperation between the two great countries. Then I would say that historic events seem to demonstrate that China and U.S. are mutually beneficial if they stick to cooperation, and confrontation will be harmful to both. China and United States need to seek common ground and manage our differences, and not to challenge the vital interests of one another. And in the days to come, I tend to have a good reason to expect that the United States and China would make efforts to strive for the win-win result in their bilateral relations, and thus making their contribution not only to an everlasting good relationship between these two great countries and two peoples, but to lasting peace and development in the Pacific basin and the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador, for that very comprehensive and also concise 10-minute remark. And let's give Ambassador 10 minutes to eat. Then I will ask the panel come, then also ask Ambassador to answer questions. So how about that, 10 minutes, please. Enjoy. Could you hear me in the back? It's okay, good. We will start the panel discussion roughly for about an hour. And let me introduce some panelists other than myself, of course, and also Ambassador Suge, who just delivered the keynote. The person next to me is Dr. Tang Jianqun. He is a director and senior research fellow at the Department of American Studies and with CIIS. He's a leading expert on security issues. And also Jonathan Pollock, my colleague, who is a leading scholar on security issues in the North Korea and also Chinese national defense. And he's a senior fellow at the John L. Thornton China Center here at Brookings. Last but not least, Richard Bush is the director of Northeast Studies Center here at Brookings. And he will leave earlier because of another engagement. And when he leaves, a distinguished colleague of mine, David Dollar at Brookings, will join to talk more on economic issues. So let us start the conversation. First, I wanted to pose every one of them a question. And for Ambassador Suge, and I was very happy to hear you talk about the three levels of analysis by Kenneth Walther at Berkeley in the 1950s, also called the three images. Basically, look at the international relations from individual leaders, from nation state, from international system. Now, there's a concern in the United States, a worry about China's increasing assertiveness in foreign policy. And someone said that it's quite proactive or even aggressive. Now, in your view, or if you are fine with that, use the three levels of analysis to tell us why that kind of worry, that kind of concern is not well-grounded to look at the Xi Jinping or other leaders, look at China as a nation, look at the international system in today's world. Why cooperation will be the theme, and how China play an important or status quo's power in the international system. Now, for Mr. Tang, since you are an expert on security, as we know that there's some tensions about or serious concerns in both countries about cybersecurity. Do you think that it will be possible that some breakthrough during President Xi Jinping's visit to the United States? Something like what happened during Obama's last trip to China, the climate change, we made some historically important agreement in terms of climate change, reduce air pollution and et cetera. So if so, what barriers we should overcome? For my colleague Jonathan Pollock, that there's an increasing concern in Beijing and in China. Some people believe that the U.S. policy towards China has changed, especially Washington atmosphere has changed. Now, could you tell us your observation whether that view is valid? Or you think that the U.S.-China relation or U.S. policy, White House policy towards China has not changed? And could you respond about that concern, especially from our Chinese friends? And finally, for my colleague Richard Bush, that earlier we heard that Ambassador Suge mentioned that Xi Jinping's visit
will likely be the last summit between these two top leaders. As we know that Obama, in his final couple of years, he really determined to do things what he thinks is right. You know, he's not so interested about domestic politics anymore. So whether it be Cuba, Iran deal, and etc., he wants to do the right things. And in your view, what are the right things he should do with this state visit? What are the areas or possible mistakes he should avoid or be seen as opportunity lost? So these are the questions. Since Richard, you are the person to... Oh, it's okay. So let Ambassador Su to answer my question about why that some of the worry in Washington and the United States and also China's neighboring countries about China's new foreign policy, China's growing power, or the views about assertiveness, aggressiveness, may be not valid from your perspective.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lee. And I'm so glad to share this podium with my colleagues here who have been friends and in addition to colleagues for a long time. Dr. Lee, you raised an excellent question. However, in order to answer this, I would like to share with you what I have found. I would like to share with you just a finding during my visit, recent visit to Europe. I visited the European Center for China Studies in France. They also used the term assertive about Chinese foreign policy recently. However, they added, now it seems to them Chinese foreign policy has not only been assertive, but reactive. He said, well, when you see a few things China has to make a response, Chinese foreign policy have been making reactions to a few things which have been initiated by our neighbors. For instance, Diao Yudao, now it has been there in the dormant since, let's say, Deng Xiaoping's visit to Japan in the 70s. Deng Xiaoping says, well, and we have different opinions regarding Diao Yudao Island, and at the moment, we need to proceed with normalization and with China's modernization program, and these are paramount tasks. As for these islands, our future generation got to be wiser than us, of course, owing to the most recent purchasing of the islands of and this and that, and China had to make a response. So I wouldn't want to go into details for this impressive group of gathering. Now you asked me to give an answer from the international national personality levels. I would glad to do that. Now speaking of the international level, when you look at Chinese foreign policy making, you would tend to see that now against the background of globalization and multipolarity, China has been a benefactor. Of course, China is a participant and will be making having more consultation with the United States as a responsible member of the international community, will try to make a contribution there. But China has been a benefactor. There is no reason why China should upset the whole international setting. Only in our foreign policy, you could see that China now states that we would like to together with the international community, we try to reform some of the existing orders which would not be conformity with the wishes of the international community. It's not to alter or change or upset the whole basis of international order, so to speak. I think China is the one which would definitely need a more lasting peace and international order, which would have a, would promote peace and development. And we would want a peaceful and stable international and regional situation for China's domestic construction and for the raising of people's living standards and for China's legal reforms and so on and so forth. That would bring me to my viewpoint on the national level. I think that during our discussions earlier, I think some people already rightfully put forward the notion that as a country grows, so do the national interests. Speaking of China's economic development, as you see that in the early stages, China had more emphasis on attracting direct foreign investment, attracting to China foreign like technology, and invite provide a platform for foreign companies in China. So we would call the whole process as a 请进来, that means inviting people to come in. As China's economy developed to a certain stage, only by relying to inviting people to come in, it's not going to be sufficient for the economy. So we have to adopt a new strategy, which would be a combination of both invitation, inviting others to come, or we invite others to join us so that the two of us, we would go out, reaching out, outreaching. That means 请进来 and 走出去, and it would be a combination. And speaking of the China's opening to the outside world and China's reforms, I would like just to use this example so as to quench some of the or ease some of the anxieties or worries of our American, some of the American friends, because some people are saying that China is now tightening some of the of domestic controls. Looks like China is going to continue with the domestic reforms, but narrowing the doors of opening to the outside world. I would like to use this One Belt and One Road initiative to just to demonstrate that China is not only having the emphasis on domestic reform, but then China is going to remain on the road of opening to the outside world. During the Westward Movement, the initiative, just by opening to the outside world, because China is not going to do this alone. This is an ongoing process. We would like to invite the United States companies, United States high tech, to come and join with the Chinese production capabilities. So the two of us, together with members of international community, we can explore new frontier in the West Asia and Europe. If that being said, my personal opinion is that by opening to the outside world, which is a direction China is likely to go on, and in turn, it would push domestic reforms to another higher stage. In Chinese, we call this 对外开放倒逼国内的经济改革. By opening to the outside world, you can exert a force so that the domestic reforms would move on and go to another higher stage. Okay, I'll only use this as one example. Speaking of a personality level and decision-making level, I'll only say that
probably to any, I cannot speak for our president. However, as a student of international relations and politics, I tend to feel that for any leaders at that level, he has to face up a whole myriad of different situations, scenarios. Now, Chinese leaders often have a saying that it looks like we are now living in a flat world. Domestic situation more and more intertwined with the international situation. Anything domestic, you'll find maybe more and more report by international press. And what happens internationally, and then it would have the impact on China's domestic situation. For instance, once I accompanied the Chinese leader when I was ambassador to Iceland, you know, 2008, the world witnessed a financial crisis. And that Chinese leader, when I accompanied him, I asked him about his agenda, what he would consider most as days the work would start. He said, well, when you start, you think that this year we are going to have an addition of 5 million to 6 million college graduates. Can we find enough jobs to him? He said, I have been to the ports many times in Shandong. He said, this time when I was there in my limousine, when I got out, it's not business as usual. It's like, it looks like it's the production is, and there are fewer, very few people on the docks. He was saying that whatever happens in Wall Street, you can feel an impact not only in China's docks, you can even the peasant workers in China can feel about it. So that being said, I think that to have a favorable, stable international situation is connected with Chinese domestic reforms and with Chinese domestic politics and economics. And with that being said, I think that when China and United States, we look for ways to ease our differences and we look for more ways to cooperate, I think that would be in alignment with the Chinese national interests, and I think that would be good for that is something the Chinese ordinary Chinese people would wish to see. We want to be friends with the United States.
Thank you very much, Ambassador, for spending time to answer my question in details. Now, let's before the Q&A, I want to turn to Richard Bush, since he will leave earlier to answer my question. Then I will leave the floor open for Q&A for these two early speakers. Then how about that? Okay, Richard.
Well, I'll be brief. Thank you, Cheng. It's a pleasure to be on the same panel with Dr. Suga, Ambassador Suga, whom I deeply respect. As a prelude to my answer, let me say that I have no doubt that President Xi Jinping and President Barack Obama will interact with each other with deep and genuine respect. That's a given. So what should they avoid? I think they should avoid polite talk at a high level of generality that avoids critical issues. Because they have respect for each other, they can be frank with each other. So I don't know what will be on President Obama's mind, but I expect that he will not avoid talking about his concerns concerning cybersecurity, activities in the East Asian maritime domain, trends in Chinese domestic politics, and so on. I don't know what Xi Jinping is going to talk about, but perhaps it will include the U.S. rebalance policy, U.S. relations with our allies, and their impact of those relations on East Asian security, U.S. military operations in East Asia, and U.S. views of the AIIB and One Belt, One Road. Now, what opportunities should they seize? I think what is probably most important is that they agree on a work plan that the two countries should undertake for the next 18 months through the remaining time of President Obama's administration, and focusing on issues that require presidential leadership. There are a lot of issues in the relationship, and a lot of them can be dealt with through the SNED and through agency interaction. But some issues really require president direction and presidential monitoring to ensure that they are being addressed with the best interests of the two countries involved. And I think that that would be a very useful initiative. Thank you.
I want the audience to, you know, have a chance to ask a question for both of them. Before that, I have a follow-up question for my colleague Richard Bush. I agree with you that we need to talk about tough issues, but also we should keep that in mind. We are not only just dealing with the president, but also dealing with, you know, the nation, 1.4 billion people. There's a growing concern that the United States always wants to lecture China, or even, you know, sometimes humiliate China. This will be a wonderful opportunity for president to communicate with the Chinese public, because the media, you know, will cover extensively. So in that regard, how you see that opportunity to convey American goodwill, in what way will be the most effective?
It's a good question. I guess the answer that comes immediately to mind is to do an interview with CCTV or some other outlet before the visit, an extended interview, which by mutual agreement is going to be broadcast in its entirety in China, but where he can sort of reassure China about our fundamental intentions in the same way that Suga was talking about reassurance of the United States.
Thank you very much. Actually, Tian Wei is in your delegation. She will be ideal candidate to interview President. Where is she? Tian Wei?
Just because of the visa issue from the U.S. Embassy, she had to cancel the visa.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah. That's terrible. She, as we know, that she is the anchor woman of the English program CCTV. And so now, for audience, I maybe start with journalists, either American journalists or Chinese journalists. Mr. Chen from China Daily.
Hi, I'm Chen from China Daily. I want to ask Richard. You talked about they should not avoid talk about such a sensitive issue, but it's not just talk. They talked maybe since Sunnyland, but what China and the U.S., each side should specifically do, I mean, maybe compromise or make concessions on both these sensitive issues, what they are willing to do. What's your suggestion? I mean, obviously not to shut down the media, as the ambassador said, we are to blame for the souring relationship. Thank you.
A good question. First of all, let's be clear that this relationship is not all about conflict. There are areas of cooperation. The Iran agreement is a good example of that. I think that there may be opportunities in the cyber area where there can be agreement at the top that certain aspects of the cyber realm are off limits to the activities of the other side. And so critical infrastructure seems to be one where there's a mutual interest that neither side will attack the other. Can that be sort of pursued in a way that increases mutual confidence and allows for proper monitoring? I don't know. I'm not an expert at all on this, but that's one idea that comes to mind.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah, please. Yeah. No, microphone. Wait for microphone. Yeah.
Hi, Margaret Brennan from CBS News. Thank you for doing this. Ambassador, I'm interested in many of your thoughts, but in your thoughts in particular on this issue of cyber, because since Sunnylands, there have been a number of reports, very high-profile cases of hacking that many U.S. officials have privately linked and said that they have great suspicion that Chinese hackers were behind it. I'm thinking, of course, of the OPM hacking. Today, there was extensive reporting in the Wall Street Journal about United Airlines, a commercial airline company, allegedly hacked by Chinese hackers. So since Sunnylands, have you seen any progress? What is the thought in China, and what do you expect to happen in September?
Thank you very much. That's another very important question. Of course, I cannot speak for the president. I'm not a cyber specialist. However, just from the Chinese from the viewpoint of a Chinese think tanker, I tend to see this as in this way. For instance, a glass with half glass of water, whether it's a glass half empty or half full, I tend to, instead of having a more pessimistic view, I tend to have a more positive view on this. For instance, in China and U.S., we have lots of different issues regarding the South China Sea, cyberspace, etc. Instead of only finding differences, can we find a way so that we can look for positive results, a direction in which both sides can cooperate? For instance, I think cyber space, security is such a vital, important area. I think both United States, not only the government, but the cyber, the website, the users, we all want safety and unaffected usage and the passage of information. I thought maybe at the level of the presidential summit meeting, they have a very limited time. I think that prior to that, maybe it's a good idea for think tankers, for concerted like groups, working groups, to meet so that they can put forward insights and policy solutions. For instance, both sides would recognize the importance of security and the safety of the internet, and neither would want to attack the most vital installations infrastructure of the other, and then both sides would look for ways so as to make certain that we have exchanges and in this regard. So I'm thinking of some positive ways so that we can move out from this debate. I think so that the at the presidential meeting, both sides they would talk about. Of course, I agree with Richard when he said that the Chinese. Normally, because of historic of Chinese culture, Chinese tend to think about something general. So when we tell each other, let's make friends with each other, we do not ask each other, what can I do for you or what can you do for us? And during the last few, say, S-E and D, and we took note of the fact the United States wanted to have something concrete. You wanted to have something which might be called the deliverables. So that both sides agreed on over 120 new agreements. And then after that, people we find that people would say, well, that's a little too many. It's hard for us to remember what you have completed. But anyway, I think that if we adopt, for instance, in addition to climate, we can also talk about climate change in addition. By the way, you've definitely got a climate expert here, sitting here. Why? When I was transferred from the Caribbean to Iceland, the president of Iceland asked me, hey, how... why is this change? You were stationed close to Ecuador, now close to the North Pole. I replied, against the background of climate change, you've got to have an expert.
Okay.
Right, thank you.
Well, I'll go back to the cybersecurity issue. And first, that David, would you please join us? Thank you, Richard. Yeah, I want to follow up the cybersecurity issue to our distinguished panelist who is an expert in this area, and particularly meal-to-meal relations. And when we talk about cybersecurity, we actually also refer to three sub-areas. One is certainly talk about the hike. The second is commercial espionage. And the third is the access of the market, like the Facebook or Google or LinkedIn, and also there's a freedom of the internet in China itself. These kind of three issues. Now, I'm sure that all these issues will be raised. And in your view, which area has the potential to reach agreement, even become headline for Xi Jinping's visit?
In terms of the cyberspace security, actually, I think Chinese government and the U.S. government both attach great importance to the cooperation in this regard. To my knowledge, I think the first question raised by your president, by President Obama, during Sunnyland, a meeting with cyberspace security. Actually, it should be a surprise to our president why, the United States president gave such a question to the meeting. At that time, I think China and the United States both have different understandings approaching to the cyberspace security. And, we talked a lot about the cyberspace security, for example, the not to use the website as a platform to do some anti-government, propaganda, which will give a lot of trouble for the stability of China. And we learned lessons from the Arabic Spring in recent years. This is actually our attention on the cyber space security. And why the United States has attached importance to the anti-criminal activities in cyberspace, not only the espionage, but also the hacking activities by a non-state actor and some others. So we have different understandings on the definition, at least, of cyberspace security. And actually, the wide use of information technology has completely changed the social life. For example, I joked to my friends in Stanford University the day before yesterday. I think the WeChat has completely changed, destroyed the life, the communication, even between husband and wife. My wife returns to home after 10 hours work from her office. She will pick up her cell phone and just play the WeChat, and no communication with me. I hate the WeChat. So this is a completely changed the social life or even the communication between wife and husband. So I think we are facing the common challenge. But at this moment, to my understanding, China and the United States have different understandings. Dr. Li Cheng just asked, what is most serious barrier or obstacle on the way for China and the United States to cooperate? I think the consensus. The United States has attached great importance to the anti-criminal, you know, activities in cyberspace, while China might be, you know, has attached great importance to the sovereignty in cyberspace. This is the big gap between the two countries. So the first, I think the largest obstacle we are facing now is, can we have a consensus to cooperate in cyberspace for the security and for the safety of the this new domain?
Thank you. So probably you agree with Ambassador that maybe both sides should sign agreement and not attack you know, infrastructure or this kind of basic principles. We need to reach some agreement at least, right? Okay. Now, I wanted Jonathan to answer my question about whether Washington has changed in regarding policy toward China. But also, since David just joined us, I also have a question for you. Do you think that China, you know, President Xi Jinping will invite Obama again to join AIIB? And if so, what the, you know, answer he will give, I mean, from Obama in your view, because he worked in the Treasury Department before joining Brookings. The same things with the concern about TPP. Of course, that is still, it's not signed yet, and but in 2 months, probably we have an even better sense. So what's the U.S. position regarding the future scenario of China joining TPP? Because there's some there are two different views in China. One, you think that TPP will, China is not ready in many ways. The other thing is that this is part of the, you know, try to exclude China in the international economic integration. So your position on that. So Jonathan first.
Thank you, Chen. President Xu, I can't resist the temptation when you pose the issue of your glass of water. Is it half full or half empty? I could fill it, and then we won't have to ask that question anymore. The question Chung has posed to me is in a way, a very, very simple one, but also very, very complicated. When we ask questions of the predominant directions of U.S. policy towards China, it's, of course, dominated from the White House, but it involves many, many branches of government or different parts of the bureaucracy, so often we have to ask, who in particular are we trying to show a light on? But having said that, policymakers generally don't have the luxury of starting from scratch. They can't reinvent the world on the basis of momentary trends. Policy machinery very, very seldom, if ever, works that rapidly. There's, in fact, if anything, much more continuity, I would argue, across administrations. What we have as factors that are influencing this perception is the fact that the tone and the tenor of coverage, both in the mass media in both countries and among those we like to call the commentariat, seems quite different. The question is why. On the one hand, we could say by the very nature, the media process seeks controversy, contention. It has to. That's the line of work that they are in. Otherwise, what's the point? If you simply report good news or boring news, it's not going to get the attention you want. And at the same time, often the loudest voices are the most privileged voices. The other factor, I think, that influences this, of course, is the looming presidential competition for nomination and then for election. There are many people who aspire to be advisors and to influence this process. All of this, of course, is very much related to the question of how big might China be as a factor in the presidential election. Frankly, I think there are foreign policy issues that are going to be much, much bigger. Iran, Russia, the continued upheaval all across the greater Middle East, probably will be larger, but that doesn't mean that people don't try to inject these issues in the process. But having said that, and having, you know, and expressing my wariness about the starkness often of the pictures that are being presented of the decision-making process, these controversies have not arisen out of thin air. They reflect real issues, as we are talking about already on this panel. So the question I think we have to ask ourselves, even if I don't see some kind of an abrupt change coming in U.S. policymaking, is do we see these controversies as simply the growing pains of an evolving and much more complex relationship that needs to be intelligently managed over time? Or are we at the gestational stages of a longer-term competition that contains adversarial or quasi-adversarial dimensions? Those are very big issues. I'm just flagging it. Maybe others want to react to it. The real question would be whether or not there is a sufficiently shared awareness of the risks posed by the latter, that it receives the kind of careful attention that it deserves in both policy processes.
Thank you. Excellent. And David.
Okay, thank you very much. First question was about AIIB. I think it's widely agreed in the United States now that it was a mistake for the U.S. government to try to oppose the launching of AIIB and discourage allies from joining. President Obama's most recent statement about it was relatively positive, you know, welcoming the development of new financing for infrastructure, encouraging the World Bank to work together with AIIB. It's hard to see the Obama administration changing gears and trying to join at this point. It would be very hard to get this through Congress. You know, I think in the nature of diplomacy, it's just more likely we'll see a further positive statement from President Obama about the potential for AIIB and the desirability of having the World Bank work together with it. That's the most I would expect in that front. The TPP question is very interesting. The trade ministers are meeting in Maui this week. Hopefully they're not on the beach. Hopefully they're locked in a room, and no one will let them out of the room until we have an agreement. So still some difficult issues. But I'm cautiously optimistic it'll be agreed this week, which means it can go through the whole approval process in the U.S. and actually be voted on by Congress before January, you know, before our presidential election season really heats up. That's quite positive. China's not part of the negotiation. Soon as it's agreed, I think new members will be on the agenda. South Korea, perhaps Indonesia, will want to join quickly. I see it, all the members want China to join. The benefits would be much larger if China joined. It'll be a big step for China. And I see the bilateral investment treaty as a very important step in the right direction because the BIT includes a lot of the measures that are in TPP, but it, you know, it's not, but many measures are not covered. So if we can't negotiate the BIT, then there's no real progress for China to join TPP in the foreseeable future. I'm disappointed that the BIT negotiations are going slowly. You know, China apparently came with an initial negative list, which is very long and disappointing to the U.S. We're not going to reach an agreement on that before President Xi's visit, but the two sides are supposed to exchange new drafts of negative lists in early September. If China comes with a significantly improved negative list, that'll create a positive momentum for negotiations. So you could imagine the two presidents, you know, agreeing to move ahead aggressively. But that really will require China to open up a lot. The problem is China's service sectors are almost completely closed. China is the most closed of the G20 countries when it comes to foreign investment. And so I agree with something Ambassador Suga said. This would be a big positive push for China's domestic reform. So this is the best hope on the economic side, is that the two aggressively pursue bilateral investment treaty.
Thank you so much, David. Very clear answer. So, audience question. Anyone? Yeah. Alan? Yeah, please. One microphone in the front, one in the back, please.
Alan Romberg Stimson. Good to see you, Mr. Ambassador. A lot of positive words about the importance of cooperation, having a spirit of moving ahead together, and I agree with all of them. But I think we need to face the fact, at least as I see it, that the mood that Jonathan was talking about is importantly tied not just to the big issues such as cyber or trade or human rights, but specifically to the South China Sea. I think that if it were not for concerns about China's behavior and potential ambitions, which are not all that clear, that you would have a different sort of tone to a lot of the commentary in the United States about that. So I would hope that in the summit meeting that Chung is asking about, that there would be a pretty direct, frank, open discussion with people both talking and listening about that subject to see what can be done to manage that issue better. Without that, I think that the likelihood is that we see a spillover in a lot of ways. We see the mood in the Congress, which I think is affected by it. We're going to see more discussion of Taiwan, which has its own special issues with regard to the election. But I think that some people's attitude toward U.S. policy is affected by concerns about China's behavior. So I would highlight that. I don't think we can just let that sort of be a generalized point.
Thank you. We'll probably pick up a couple more. And, the gentleman, yeah.
Thank you. George Condon with National Journal. I wanted to return to the comment the ambassador made before and address this also to Jonathan. You said the view in China is that the president tries to lecture and maybe humiliate the Chinese. The view in the United States is that the president doesn't stand up to China on the construction of islands for military uses, on cyber attacks. The two countries can't even agree on what the tone of the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II should be. Why should we not think this summit is going to be a disaster?
Okay, very pointed question. And you wanted to ask Ambassador to answer, or Johnson, or both?
Anybody.
Okay. Now we take another one. I hope the Chinese journalist in the room. Yes.
Hi, I'm Sally Zhang from CCTV America. Well, this year marks the conclusion of the Second World War. So during the President Xi's visit, will the two presidents talk about the international order? Thank you.
Thank you. Particularly the very interesting question about the two sides. When in the U.S., you know, we have domestic politics, we certainly think that the president should stand up as early on. Richard Bush also mentioned should candidly discuss all these issues. But at the same time, doing so, that how we reconcile the other concern, which should probably undermine American interests in a certain way, but how to reconcile this tension. And David, you wanted to add one thing? Yeah, Robert. Robert Daly.
Thank you. Robert Daly with the Wilson Center. I have a question about rhetoric more than policy. I know that our Chinese friends over the past 2 years have heard repeated American concerns about the use of this phrase, new type or model of major power relations, and that China has taken note of American leaders studiously avoiding this phrase. And yet I'm struck that China still seems wed to this phrase as a hallmark of success in the relationship, and I worry that use of this could actually undermine General Secretary Xi's trip to the United States. Do you see any possibility of, without changing China's goals or its analysis of U.S.-China relations, that this phrase, as a TIFA, might be put down and put aside?
Okay. Now, more interesting questions. So who wants to start?
Okay, my boss giving me an assignment to answer Alan's question about South China Sea. You know, I used to work as a staff in the South China Sea Fleet headquarters, you know, during my 20s, you know. And I participate in the preparation for the construction of the observation station in Nansha Islands in 1987. And in 1988, we had a clash with the Vietnamese Navy in Chigua Reef. I just watched that clash. It's only a 30 or 40 minutes clash between the two navies. Actually, the construction in Nansha Island is an assignment from the UNESCO Maritime Committee in 1987. At that time, there was a resolution adopted by the Maritime Committee to construct an observation station in not only in South China, but also, you know, in other, you know, countries, we altogether have 300. And according to that resolution, China, you know, got 4 observation station construction, 1 in Nansha Island, the number 74. And we finished the construction at the end of 1988. And till now, the observation station, you know, have already submit about 2 million, you know, pieces of information to WMO. So this is actually the origin of the construction in South China Sea is from the UN relevant organizations. And I think why this time enlarge the, you know, the buildings in the facilities in Nansha, actually, I think the main target is to improve our living condition. You know, the condition there is very humid, very hot, and no water. So you have to improve your living condition for our, you know, scientists and soldiers. So this is a region for the construction. And also, we talked a lot about UN Cross. And my colleague Wang Hailing is an expert, you know, about international law in this regard. I think the UN Clause is not only the, you know, law defining the, you know, the issues in South China Sea. We still have another, you know, legal documents. For example, Cairo Declaration, Potsdam, you know, a proclamation, and also the surrounding document signed by the Japanese government, just gave the clear-cut, you know, announcement that Japan should return these island reefs, shells to China. And Kuomintang government at that time also sent a task force, at least 6 battleship, to, you know, recover these islands. So this is a history. We should, this another side of the law, of the international law, to give the, you know, the sovereignty to China, return to China. Not only the UN Clause is not only the international law. So why China, you know, continue the construction there is actually a legitimate you know, action by the United Nations and also by the historical documents.
Okay. Well, please, Jonathan.
There are several questions I wanted to raise. George Condon has raised the interesting possibility, why shouldn't this trip be a disaster? And those are strong words. Disaster is a big word. President Xi will be in the United States, I think, for approximately, what, about five days? A lot of his time will not be, tellingly, will not be in Washington, D.C. Very little of his time will be in 24 hours. So the question is whether, in that context, as we say, to use an American word, the optics of the visit will be presented in a way that people will feel either, A, that it was not a disaster, or that there might actually be something constructively done in the process. And that's, frankly, what staffs do. They can't control for everything, but they can try to control for most. And, you know, frankly, I don't think that either government has any incentive to come out of this meeting with the sense that it has gone very, very badly. Now, you can't control for media content. No matter how bright the clouds and the sun might look, I can assure you some of the media will find some dark clouds and certainly some rain, since this will be in Washington. Maybe there'll be some rain for the occasion. But, you know, I think it's, you know, a lot of trips are remembered in different ways precisely because of how things appear in that context. The fact that there's all this sniping that goes on in both countries' media processes, I mean, you know, if I were advising President Obama, I would let that slide off his back. He's got more important things to worry about than that. The other issue I wanted to address is what Robert Daley raised, which is a great issue. The question is the utility of a concept. And in this case, President Xi is very, very strongly identified with this idea, although it's been expressed to some extent by other Chinese leaders. It speaks, though, I think, to a larger question, because I don't expect President Xi to set it to one side. That seems, shall we say, uncharacteristic of what we can observe about him or any Chinese leader. But it does raise, Robert, the question of ownership of a concept, ownership of views. In fact, the CCTV America correspondent asked the question, will they talk about the future of the international order? I hope so, although they don't have a lot of time to talk. But I'm wondering whether the only way we will arrive at some kind of mutually acceptable definition of terminology is if neither country and neither leadership can take ownership of the concept. So maybe we need to have a different kind of competition and let either scholars or maybe even another government come up with an idea, something that addresses these issues but isn't associated with a Chinese or an American brand. That's at least my own thinking. I know the odds on that are not high.
Yeah, thank you. I'll start with an answer to the excellent question posed by CCTV America. I think that when President Xi Jinping comes to the United States and the United Nations headquarters in New York City, this is a very important occasion for both the summit and his United Nations visit. Because the United States and China, the two, we fought together in the war against fascism 70 years ago. In fact, China and United States, we were comrades in arms, and both participated in the war, and then after the war, there had been a number of important international legal documentations guiding for the post-war world order, which still have important effects today's world, international order. I think both the United States and China, we have a duty in safeguarding a continuation of the international order, which would pave the way for future lasting peace and development. And another thing I would like to say that now there was a question on what term could be used to summarize characterize the very important relationship between the two great nations, United States and China. I would think that what kind of words you can find out or you can agree upon to describe a relationship that can be discussed. However, whatever terminology that could be agreed upon and cannot alter the fact that no matter which way the relationship goes, it's got to be an important strategic relationship, because the relationship between the United States and China, for better or for worse, it's not only confined with the two peoples, two countries, but it's got to have an impact on the Asia-Pacific region and even in the world. So I hope that no matter what, the relationship has to be a new type of relationship between this leading nations, number one, and number two, economies. And as for TPP, I tend to quote a notion initiated by American scholars and some Chinese scholars. That is, if you target somebody as your enemy, he's going to be your enemy. So TPP, although when you look at some of the scholarly works
comments, you find that some people have more worries about it. But I tend to have a more optimistic view. I tend not to regard this as something as a menace. I thought that down the road, maybe we can find something which we can agree upon, and we can find a way in which United States and China can have a cooperation so far as the TPP, for the arrangements of the TPP is concerned. BIT, briefly, I hope that after the first exchange of negative list, United States felt that the Chinese list is a little too long. However, down the road, as we exchanged the first after the first exchange of notes, that's a good basis, and we can move on from that and continue with our discussions. During the time, I think that both sides have concerns. We hope that each side's concerns will be heard by the other. We have heard of your concern. However, the Chinese also felt that we want to buy more products. We want to enhance the American volume of trade, so the things that you can sell to China. But there are a number of the things we want to buy. You just don't want to sell to us. And a number of Chinese companies wanted to increase their investment in China. And however, and the doors do not seem to be that open. So we hope that you'll convey our concerns to the American Congress in addition to others, so that you'll open the doors a little wider for this. Finally, why this summit would not be a disaster? I would say that as the Chinese saying goes, the administration, they are the boat. They are the ships. They are the boats. The people are the water. The water supports the boat. I think that a success of a summit, a basically cooperative relationship between the United States and China in the days to come, fits the general interests of our both countries and of both of our peoples. That's why I think that if the administration make a decision to guide the relationship along the right path, and that fits the people's interests, and that for the American administration, they will win more votes from the general voters. Thank you.
Thank you. David. Just briefly on this question of whether the visit might be a disaster, just focusing on the economic side. You know, there will be quite a few big deals signed alongside, maybe not necessarily part of the formal program, but normally when you've got this kind of presidential visit, there'll be some big trade deals signed, there'll be some big investment deals signed. My own sense is if we're not making progress on real economic integration, you know, when we're not changing the foundation through something like the BIT, then I think American people are going to react badly to having a lot of big deals. Frankly, it's going to look a little bit like China's, you know, trying to buy friendships by buying airplanes, for example, or buying companies. If we don't really change the foundation, then we're not going to get a more balanced economic relationship, and that's what the administration and the American people are looking for.
Well, well said. I also want to respond to your question about the possible disaster. I think that when you look back, the U.S.-China relation, especially President Obama's first trip, you know, in the first year of his administration to China, which was perceived by American media as a disaster, as a failure. To a certain extent, that is to do with his speech in Shanghai Science Building, which he feel that he did not have a forum to communicate with Chinese people. So therefore, back at home, people think that he was too soft, he did not state American principles. That really played a very important role in his mindset, if I interpret, you know, try to interpret. So certainly that I echo what my colleague David and also Ambassador said, that the relationship is so important. Neither president wants to be to see as a failure. And we need to see the real progress. The progress, in addition to what David said, it's on the economic front, which is important. But equally important, we should see real change, change in American perception of China, Americans' good intention with China's development, to see China's own political development with the rule of law, human rights, and civil society, and et cetera. And I think this provides a great opportunity for both leaders. But I think the stakes so high, I think I absolutely agree with Ambassador. American people, based on my observation, same things with Chinese people. They want the relationship to be the right, to be moving forward, to make some progress. Now, of course, there's some people maybe want to see a disaster. Of course, that I hope that it's a very, very small number of people. I hope these people will be disappointed, because otherwise we foresee so many problems: cybersecurity, economic integration, I mean, nuclear nonproliferation, and so many other issues. So with that, I hope that the audience will join me. I'm sorry that we cannot take so many questions. They can stay for a few minutes to answer questions directly, but I want you to join me to thank our distinguished panelists for that very, you know, kind of uplifting, but of a very analytical discussion about that very, very important relationship at a very critical moment. Thank you very much. Thanks.